This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2018, held in Harrisonburg, Virginia on March 2 and 3.
As you saw on the schedule, it's a time for question and answer, discussion, and so forth. So I came with nothing prepared for this afternoon. I've had a few questions that came in, and I'm assuming that if you're here, you either are curious what everybody else wants to know, or probably, more probable, you have some questions of your own. So I'm looking forward to hearing from you. I might have to pull the, you know, standard school teacher occasional answer of, that's a really good question. What do the rest of you think? You know, a few times this afternoon, we'll see how this goes. But maybe I'll kick off with a few questions that people have asked me. So here's a question. I talked some this morning about scholarship program and how those donations should be handled, or how that income should be handled, and so forth. So I had someone ask me, they said, okay, they had a donor that donated to the school and was a little disappointed that their scholarship wasn't higher given the amount that they donated. And so they kind of made an agreement with the school that, okay, if I donate to the school, then I will get at least X percent of that donation as a scholarship for my children. And he was just wondering, okay, so now is this okay, or how can we do this? Okay, so if you understand the issue here, what we're basically saying is we want to give a donation to a scholarship program so that we get the tax benefits. So we're getting, in this case, they were from Virginia, so they're getting, you know, the 65% tax credit in Virginia. But now I expect this money to be used to give me a scholarship. Okay, here's the problem. And we're coming back to what we talked about this morning, and that is control. So who has control over this money? In this case, the donor is attempting to exert control over how their donation is used so that it's used for their own benefit. My response would be, no, that's not okay. To make an agreement that if you give, then you'll get a nice big scholarship, that sounds way too close to private enrollment. It sounds way too close to using a tax benefit or to using a nonprofit to get a personal benefit. To say, yes, you can apply, and we'll consider you along with everyone else, no problem with that. There is no problem with you donating to a school that your children benefit from, or that you benefit from because your children go there, but who has control over the donation? My answer there is that sounds unfortunate, but really wouldn't want to be in a situation like that. I had somebody ask me, I talked about tuition discounts, things like that. They had said, okay, so do some schools actually give discounts to board members' children? And I'm going to have to back up a bit there. When I'm talking about discounts, I've seen it a lot more often with either the administrator or the principal or the teachers. You know, the students, the children of teachers would often get a discount or maybe even free tuition. I'm not aware of any situation where just because you're on the board, your children get a discount. But I could be wrong there. Yeah.
Would the board have to make that decision?
As far as who gets a discount?
If the board members get a discount.
Wouldn't that be neat? yes, they would.
And that would be a problem.
To a point, but somebody has to make the decision. Now here's where I would go with that. I probably would want it to be a broader discussion than just among board members, and particularly if all the board members have children in school. Now, if there were... The board could initiate the conversation. It would be about as comfortable as ministers initiating conversation about paying your pastor. You know, ever been in conversations like that? Who wants to bring that one up? But sometimes it needs to be brought up, you know, and sometimes you have to, have the guts to bring it up. But that is a good point. And you can't have a board that is clearly, you know, working in their own self-interest. Here's where I would say you should have a conflict of interest policy in place. So if you have a case where, okay, I'm gonna make up a scenario, but a scenario where parents with more than four children in school get free to, you know, might be eligible for free tuition, you know, sometimes or however this works. If a board member is in a case like, you know, meets the criteria, the preset criteria, but, you know, it still needs to be cleared by the board or something, he should excuse himself from the room. The remaining board members discuss it and reach a conclusion. So it's just a very common conflict of interest situation. But yes, you could easily run into a conflict of interest scenario. Come on in, there's still plenty of room. So, discounts. Are any of you aware of situations where board members get discounts and free tuition just by virtue of being board members? Okay. Well, maybe you have to go back and implement that. I don't know. Any suggestion there? Another question someone asked, should we give our local churches a donation receipt for their offering? So church takes an offering, gives it to the school. Should the school then issue a donation receipt to the church? Okay, for my first response is it really doesn't matter because the church doesn't need it. The church is already a nonprofit. They're not getting any tax benefit from giving a donation. So from the church standpoint, they don't need to receive a receipt. It really wouldn't benefit them at all. From a school standpoint, it might be a good idea for a couple of reasons. One, if it's just standard procedure, follow the same procedure. Why make an exception in this one case? Number two, it helps you to document how much you received. And part of that is so that if you have an internal control policy in place, and by internal control, I'm talking things like, you know, one person signs the checks, another person reconciles the bank statement, for instance. You know, the kind of thing where everything's double-checked. If you have something in place, one of them could be that the receipts that go out are then later reconciled to the money that's being deposited. You know, so for instance, and the donor is then going to hold the organization accountable. If I would get a donation receipt for less than what I gave, I would be asking questions. So that's one way of, you know, double checking that money didn't disappear in somebody's pocket somewhere. The other way would then be to reconcile those receipts with what actually got to the bank and make sure those match. Now, you're probably still sitting there thinking, well, okay, we trust our treasurer. You do. But internal controls are for two reasons, two big reasons. One is to make sure there's not fraud. So making sure that somebody's not taking off with the money. The other is to protect the integrity of the person handling the money. So when I worked for Faith Builders, I was glad that I wasn't signing the checks. I was printing them all. I was approving the bills. I was printing the checks. I was reconciling the bank statement. I was issuing the financial reports. I was not signing the checks. Someone else was putting their name on the check. I was glad that internal control was in place because if someone who, you know, donated money or something to the organization said, we're not quite sure how this money is being spent, you know, raised a question, it wasn't all on me. Yes, I might have approved the bill, so did someone else. You are not only protecting someone from temptation, you are also protecting them from. You're just keeping everything above board so that if anybody has a question, they won't question their integrity because they know they couldn't be stealing anything. You know, these controls are in place. So as you think about controls, not only as a board are you protecting the funds, you're also protecting these people, even though it might be some extra hoops for them to jump through and there's occasionally some grumbling that why do we have to do this? It seems kind of pointless because we all trust each other, right? Yeah, we do. But it's a way of helping them to keep a clear record. No one ever doubts their integrity because these controls are in place. So just putting a little plug there for internal controls. Another question somebody asked me is, what about payments in kind? So I talked some this morning about you know, if you give somebody cash, okay, it's payroll. What if you give them a quarter beef? What if you give them things like that? Can you do that? Is that okay? I would respond sort of in two different ways. One, I would say if this is a gift that you're giving somebody, giving a teacher, that's no problem. Go for it. If this is something where you're reducing their pay because you're giving them this benefit, now I would start to say that sounds a lot more like payroll. It sounds like you're trying to pay their personal expenses on their behalf, but not increase their income. A similar thing to if my employer were to pay my electric bill for me, you know, and then not include it in my income. Well, that's great. That'd be terrific, but it's not legal. Okay, so we get into one of the things we get into is what's called de minimis or minimal benefits. And I'm just going to read what the IRS says about de minimis benefits. So the IRS comes at it from the standpoint of anything you give to somebody that works for you is taxable, unless there's an exception. Okay, so they say everything's taxable, unless there's an exception. And they say that de minimis benefits can be excluded. Here's what they have to say. You can exclude the value of a de minimis benefit you provide to an employee from the employee's wages. In other words, you don't have to include it in their W-2 at the end of the year. A de minimis benefit is any property or service you provide to an employee that has so little value, taking into account how frequently you provide similar benefits to your employees, that accounting for it would be unreasonable or administratively impracticable. Cash and cash equivalent fringe benefits, for example, gift certificates, gift cards, use of a credit card, no matter how little, are never excludable as a de minimis benefit. However, they say some like meal money and some things like that might be able to be excluded. Examples of de minimis benefits include the following. Personal use of an employer-provided cell phone, used primarily for business purposes. Occasional personal use of a company copy machine, if you sufficiently control it so that at least 85% of its use is for business purposes. Holiday or birthday gifts, other than cash, with a low fair market value. Also flowers or fruit or similar items provided to employees under special circumstances, for example, on account of illness, family crisis, outstanding performance. And goes on to mention some other things. Based on that, I would say that if you're giving somebody a gift because they're a teacher, if you give somebody a gift because they've taught for 3 years or more, something like that generally could be excluded. If you are habitually giving them a gift in lieu of paying them more, then you should probably rethink that as far as can you exclude that or should you be including. If it can't be included, the way it works is that the fair market value is included as wages to them. In that case,
if somebody's making a donation to the school in Trail of Corn, is there anything you have to watch in that?
There again, you would generally provide them a receipt that states what they gave, not the value of what they gave. So, no, I don't think that would be a problem. That would be completely fine to receive that donation. Receive it, essentially sell it, probably, unless you have a use for a trigger load of corn in your school. But, you know, in most cases would sell it. There are cases, and I will mention this is a specific maybe application of that, is if it's a vehicle, if it's a boat, if it's an airplane, things like that, transportation equipment, there are specific rules as to how that can be receipted and so forth. Here's the problem. So there are all these organizations out there where you can donate your car, you know, to a charity, and they'll, you know, sell it and you get a donation receipt for it. The problem they started running into, the IRS started running into, is that people would donate their car and say, oh yes, my car, I'm sure, was worth at least $10,000 when I donated it. They only got $500 at the auction? Well, that's not my fault. And the IRS said, no, we can't go there. So what they're saying is if someone donates a vehicle and it gets resold within 2 years, then you can only take a deduction for the amount of the sale price. Unless in the meantime, the charity ran it really hard and, you know, it decreased in value and so forth. There's exceptions there. But in general, a vehicle or a boat or an airplane that is donated, you can only take a deduction for what the charity sells it for if they just turn around. Sell it. So there are some exceptions. There's some special paperwork that needs to be signed for vehicles. But other than that, receiving goods like that shouldn't be a problem. Answer your question there. There's a question.
Well, I would give an example of giving something as part of the wages. I was still in school when I was helping my dad dad on the farm, and I was married, and part of his pay for me, he gave me a quarter of beef. And I, so I went to an accounting teacher, check this out, and I said, do I need to count this part of the income? He thought a little bit, and he said, there's no way to track this, so you don't have to. So I had to.
But, yes, bad sign.
Yeah. Now, I do have a further question, like, one of my things in life is how to stretch the dollar. And I do believe the teachers should be paid right, but still making the dollar go to the farmers. If a teacher was paid less maybe than what they're worth, but the school, now not the board, but individuals in the church would supply cheap housing. Some mechanic would keep their car up. Somebody would give them a quarter of beef so that they could live on $5,000 less. And it's not the board that's doing it, it's just people in the church. Mm-hmm. Then those, my understanding would be that those guests wouldn't have to count as income. Mm-hmm.
I would agree with you. And here's the primary difference I would see there is the relationship between the parties. There is not an employer-employee relationship between the mechanic and the teacher. There is between the school board and the teacher. If the mechanic was on the school board, you could maybe ask the question of whether that changes things. And depending on the situation, it might. In most cases, it wouldn't, because his mechanics is outside of his role as a school board member. But the relationship between the parties is very important there.
And then one other thing I thought about this morning is you said, you know, cash, obviously that's counted as income, mm-hmm. but a tangible property doesn't need, I mean, a tangible piece doesn't mm-hmm. have to be. So if you pay your teacher, say, you tell them you'll pay them $3,000 a year, but then you give them a 2015 Subaru at the end of the year, how's that?
I would say you are beyond the de minimis rules. in general, the fair market value of the vehicle would need to be included. And here's the interesting thing: the IRS does not set a clear line and say, at this point, you've exceeded the, you know, what de minimis is or what you may and may not do. The two things I think that they're going to look at probably more than anything, one is how often do you do it, and is it expected? So, you know, if this is a regular practice, that really starts to point toward it being, maybe being part of salary, instead of, because, you know, they're depending on that to be able to survive on the salary that you're paying them outside of that. And so then that's, you know, would be a question there. And I already forgot what I said the second thing was that I was going to bring up here. Go on. Anyway, so it would depend on several factors there, but small gifts probably would not be a problem. Larger gifts could be an issue.
So if you give a cash equivalent gift on a regular basis, say gift cards, mm-hmm. and it's kind of expected, how do you go about, do you talk to your accountant about that, tell them what you do? Is that the right way to go about it?
That's how I would go about it. Whoever does your payroll, really, because it would need to go through payroll. Mm-hmm. So the way it works, just in very practical terms, is that you have to add it to the gross income, which means that all the taxes get figured on it, and then you take out that same amount off of the net paycheck. So if I add $50, if I'm giving somebody a $50 gift card, I add $50 to their gross income, I take $50 out of their net income. What does that mean? That means their paycheck is going to be lower than if I hadn't given them this gift. Because the taxes have to come from somewhere, can't come from the gift card, because the gift card is what the gift card is. It's going to have to come out of the rest of their paycheck. A lot of people, a lot of boards, a lot of employers will increase the bonus. They'll say, all right, we're giving you a $75 bonus. We're giving it to you as a $50 gift card. The other $25 covers taxes. So it's just, it's a way of paying the taxes on that bonus for them, with the recognition that, you know, a gift card can only be spent where the gift card is to. And so they're, to force a teacher to come up with money to pay for tax on a gift card to somewhere they might have not been going to go shopping otherwise, doesn't seem quite right. And so to add a bonus to cover the taxes, I think is very nice gesture. What other questions do you have?
Talking about school policies and handbooks and stuff, and this might be a good question for the rest of the room as well as you. Is there anything we're going through right now updating what the little policies we do have? Obviously, I need to add some more. Does anybody have a good suggestion of places to pull what other schools have done? I mean, is there anybody have a good suggestion on that? That way we don't have to totally recreate the wheel.
Did you post that on the doc?
I have not. Be a good place to start.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We recently redid ours, and we used this might be a little bit overkill, but we used an Anabaptist Financial Board governance document that Merle Hurd did. Very, very complete. Okay. Probably been overkill, but from a legal perspective, it definitely covered it.
What do the rest of you do for things like that?
We went to CASB the first round and asked for input this month because we got a lot of email feedback, templates, and whatnot. That's where we started 10 years ago.
All right. So if someone were to do that, who would they email? I got somebody that's on the committee. I'm not familiar with how all this system works.
Gerald would be a really good contact. He kind of knows all those connections.
Anybody else? Where do you go for policies? If you're get right, give to you there, Leland. Then, but. Online, LegalZoom.com. I don't know. Where do people go for school policies? I'm assuming you have them, or maybe you just inherited them and you don't know where they came from.
Call to other schools and see if you can get them.
There you go. Other schools?
Thank the Lord, I'm an old school.
Except that you have the problem of you look at the policy and you say, somebody needs to update this thing.
Who wants to open that one?
The blessing and a curse.
Somebody didn't work to start with. When Berea School started, the board that was in place to get it started, they met every week for a year before the school opened.
Yeah. It's a whole new meaning of being on the school board, doesn't it?
So back to this whole thing of taxes, and I think I followed you this morning, and I think I might know the legal answer to it. I'm not sure the practical side of it. So our school is a church-run school, and we have a few non-church families that send their children. We charge them a tuition, and we handle that sort of thing. No questions there. But on the so if I donate to the general fund, and the school gets run out of the general fund, and the church gives me a donation receipt for the full amount that I donated that year, even though that's what covered money, do I have to deduct the portion of the school, of the tuition from that donation receipt? How does that work? Because our school doesn't have its own, it's an arm, it's run by the church.
And that is a very good question. Okay, so I'll answer you. No, you don't have to. at least that's my understanding. If someone were to get into trouble, it would probably be the church, because the church is saying you didn't receive any benefit. And maybe you did. So the church, when they give you a receipt, they're saying you received no goods or services in response to this gift. In that case, if you're saying, actually, I did receive a benefit, the church could actually be in trouble for making that statement, because they are making a false statement.
So that's my specific question. I haven't
been also. first word in the title is schools. This only relates to schools. I'm sorry, in the wrong workshop. Yeah, that happens. I frankly don't know where to go with that. On a practical standpoint, because... And here's where there are several different trains of thought answering this question. So you're going to hear me not giving you a definite answer this afternoon. I will tell you that. One school of thought says part of the church's responsibility is education, is religious education. So if you look at a kind of a legal description of what a church does, part of that is religious education. So if a church's role as an exempt organization is religious education, they are within their guidelines to provide this education. Whether they provide it free or whether they charge for it is immaterial. That question really doesn't need to be brought up, because it's within the reason that they exist as a nonprofit. Therefore, if you are donating to the organization in order for them to carry out their purpose, that's a donation. How they carry out that purpose is up to them. That's one school of thought. Under that line of reasoning, no, you do not need to deduct. Do not need to deduct the benefit, the value of the benefit that you receive. My personal opinion would be that you should, as a donor, you should probably ethically deduct it. I have heard schools talk about, you know, and when people come under audit, I'm trying to remember who I was talking to. Someone who had a situation like you're describing, where, you know, everything was run through offerings in the church. When the donor to the school or to the church was audited, the IRS actually, I think, disallowed a portion of their donations, saying that they actually received a benefit for it, and so they couldn't take that off. As I recollect, it went to tax court, and I think the donor may have actually won. I'm a little fuzzy on those details. Legally, I'm not sure you can make a case that you have to deduct it off of your donations, you know, when you go to write it off your taxes. My opinion is ethically you should, because I believe you receive a benefit. And even if the church isn't necessarily disclosing it, I think you still are receiving a benefit. From the church's standpoint, I'm not sure how you would track that, because you're not keeping track of how many children the donor has in school, for example. And so I think it would be completely unreasonable to ask the church to track that. Even though a few minutes ago I said the church could get in trouble for not reporting. It's a tough one.
The issue came up for us is the deacon, you know, giving these receipts and saying on the receipt the person has not received any goods or services for the... and that's an unanswered question or circle.
If you want to sort of sidestep the issue and put it in somebody else's court, you could put on a clause, you know, they receive no goods and services except for, religious or educational services. It would make it a little more slippery if they were ever to try to pin someone down. Over here.
Mentioned about your involvement with the scholarship program at the Faith Builders. Mm-hmm. Supposing somebody opts for the first line of thought that mm-hmm. the school is strictly a donation-based school. And they also go with the scholarship funds from faith builders. Would you see a contradiction or in working those two together?
Yes, I would.
I can comment on that. Our schools are totally donation-based. Mm-hmm. And so when the scholarship thing came up here in Virginia, we had lawyers done in our office look at our situation. He said, you're not eligible for the scholarship program. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's the feedback our school got when we looked at it. Okay. The one way just right what he said.
Okay.
Now, he did say that it could maybe be applied to the parents have to pay for the school material. He said you could maybe get that much out of it, but nothing towards the per pupil cost.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Here's the approach that Faith Builders took. I'll just give you an example of how we approach it when a school comes to us and says, we don't charge tuition. We say, okay, you have to, or you at least have to. Our recommendation is that you take your total expenses divided by number of pupils. That is now your tuition. Now, there is no law that says the church can't pay tuition on behalf of the people that go there. What we would prefer is that the school would keep track of each individual person, how much they are billed for tuition, and how that tuition is paid. Okay, maybe it all comes in from the church. Maybe you apply, you know, this much of this offering to this person, this much of this offering to this person, you know, you break it out. How you track that's up to you. That's the way we would like it to happen. Here's the one thing that I will go back to, the kind of the bottom line that we have drawn. The recipient must receive a benefit from the scholarship. So how can you do that if everything is run by offerings? Here's how. When you figure out what your, you know, per student cost is, let the families know that, look, here's what it costs. And so we are more or less expecting that you would contribute this much to the offering. Because you have three children in school, so that amount times three is what we would expect. Now, we recognize you might not be able to, but this is generally what we would expect. However, if you receive a scholarship, here's the amount that we receive for you. Take that off. We don't expect you to contribute that amount. We now expect you to contribute this lower amount. That is giving them a benefit from the scholarship, even if it might only be a psychological benefit. But to know that my bill, I am pulling my fair share because I got a scholarship, is a benefit, a specific benefit. So our approach is figure out what the per student amount is, treat that as your tuition, and then apply the scholarship to the individual. Make sure you let the individual know, you know, how much is being applied and so forth. We're not comfortable with schools saying, well, it's all donation basis, so it just gets dumped into the general fund and everybody benefits. It's not okay. Some schools, I think, might still do that, but it's still not okay. Yeah. Question?
In reference to Leland's question about, you know, getting attacked or seated, whatever, Would the issue of control that you talked about this morning, would that come into play there or not? In other words, if I put money in the offering, I know that offering is going to support the school that my children are going to, but I'm not controlling, there's no strings attached to that donation. Would that play into that? In other words, I'm making a donation to that church, I know what they're going to do with it, but I'm not controlling what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Does that matter if control play into that?
It does. And so the ability of the deacon or whoever it is to make the final call over how the money is used, you know, you expect they're probably going to use it a certain way, but they do have a, you know, control over that, would factor into that. Yeah, that's a sticky one.
It says, I was wondering about that whole tax thing. Our school is also run by offering, but it's announced that this offering is for the school.
Okay.
And the amount of money that's brought in for that offering goes to the school, but that's a direct. No, that is a direct benefit. In other words, mm-hmm. I know when I put that offering, the amount of money I put in, it's going straight to my children. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe legally we've got to be pulling that out of the general fund versus announcing that we're going to have a school offering. After Eric said this morning, I've always previously, we do the little envelope just with our church, and the deacon writes out, hey, this is Mount Dunstan. They're thinking this morning, oh, you mean I can't claim this as a gift? And yet, it really isn't, because my children, the value I'm getting out of school, it's not unequal value, it's unequal one way, and that is I'm getting more than I'm, and I mean, I'm getting more value. It's not that I could at least take 10% off, because they're getting, it's the other way around.
There is a difference, to further muddy the waters, there is a difference whether someone gives and says, I want it to be used this way, or whether someone is collecting and saying it will be used that way. So there's a difference in control. You know, so if your church is taking an offering, the IRS has said it's okay to take offerings for individuals, you know, even if you announce ahead of time, because you are, the organization is still in control over how the money's used.
We also, in Virginia, we have not taken the scholarship thing for the same reason, I guess you brought up, that when it's an offering over, that really gets, it seems, we felt from our standpoint, it seemed really sticky to try to say we're running an offering-based school, and yet we're trying to get scholarships. It seemed like a big mess that we said it wasn't worth the effort, I guess, to get into.
Yeah, and that's a... Sometimes you have to do cost-benefit analysis and figure out what you're going to do with that. Yes.
I had a question, and if this doesn't interest anybody else, that's fine. I'll must have a raise of hands on it. But as a business owner, say I wanted to contribute to the scholarship fund, how does that work? And it seems like PA, at least, which is where we're at, is questionable on how long they may continue that. I mean, in a way, it's kind of money slipping out of their control, which they would prefer to have under their thumb.
It is, but if you look at it from their perspective, they have a lot of stake in the, they have a lot of skin in the game too. Here's why: on average, it costs Pennsylvania between around $13,000 per child to educate a child in school. How many of you charge $13,000 or more for tuition? Okay, here's the deal: if those children weren't educated in the private setting, they would have to educate them in the public setting. They have a lot at stake to keep those children out of public schools. Now, of course, part of the issue with private education is that the best children come out of the public schools, because the best parents generally, the more wealthy parents generally have the more stable home environments, generally have better children, and so to pull all those out, now the state has another problem on its hands. But the state does have a big stake in, or a big desire to get people out of public schools, because they know that private schools are run much more efficiently. One of the biggest problems we ran into in Pennsylvania is that they only allocate a certain amount of funding for these tax credit programs. And so once that funding is full, additional businesses can't get into the program. And so we've had a lot of businesses have been turned down because the program was full. And so there is an issue where it can feel like, okay, so is this program working or isn't it? Because I got turned down, and then I applied the next year and it got turned down. It is working, and it's working really well. I don't see the program leaving. If anything, I see it going, you know, increasing in size. Part of that is that the Jews and the Catholics love the program. If they love it, they have a lot of political clout. They run their own schools. They have their own businesses. A lot of them are very wealthy businessmen, and they love programs. And so when they love a program like that, you know, they have a lot of political clout. And so I see the program probably sticking around. I'd be happy to go into detail exactly how that program works, but in general in Pennsylvania, 90% of what you give comes straight off your tax bill as a business owner. So it makes all the Virginia people drool, because they get 65% down here. So, it's still a great program. 65% is far better than about 25% that you'll get if you just give a straight donation. So 65 is amazing. But Pennsylvania's 90. Business owners generally get somewhere between 90 and 95% right back in their pocket for donations.
As a business, though, you can put money toward your taxes like that, but not request that's going to benefit you. Is that correct?
That is correct. You can recommend that it be used in a particular school, but not for a particular patron, and especially not for yourself. Mm-hmm. that is just not okay. So yeah.
But yeah, I've seen where people try to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's unfortunate is that sometimes they've been given the impression that that's what would happen with it, and so they donate, and then it doesn't happen. And they're like, well, where'd my money go? I thought it was going to come off my tuition. It's unfortunate. That's all I can say, but it's not okay. Yes.
Well, I was going to say also, the program, which operates in numerous states, has survived the legal challenge at Supreme Court level. So it doesn't, I think that helps its shelf life or its survivability. Mm-hmm. Because it's harder to strike down the law if the Supreme Court has sanctioned it.
Right. That's for sure. Yeah, from a legal standpoint, I would say it's bulletproof. It's definitely okay. And they have also specifically ruled that just because you're getting a benefit on your state tax return does not mean that you can't get a benefit on your federal return from the same donation. So there's some benefits there too.
You had just briefly mentioned the 529 situation this morning with the new tax bill. Explain how that works, just a nutshell.
Okay, so how many of you are familiar with Roth IRAs? Okay, it works very much like very closely to a Roth IRA. Essentially, on a federal level.
Now, I understand how states, it works, but I'm saying how the new rules apply to using it for K through 12 versus college.
Okay, so these plans are administered on a state level. The federal government is what determines whether the benefits are taxable when they're dispersed. So if you put money into it, historically, you put money into a 529 plan, you don't need it for college, so now you're going to pull it back out. They would both tax you on it, and they would penalize you for it. For using it for something other than the intended purpose. My understanding of the new law is they will not penalize you for using it for K to 12 education. In other words, they used to say you can only use it for college education. Now they're saying you can also use it for K to 12 education. How that looks specifically is somewhat still being determined by states. And part of what's going on here is that these are state-run programs, and the state, gives benefits, tax benefits, and so forth, with the understanding that it's only to be used for college. Suddenly the federal government says, nah, you could use it for K to 12 as well. And the states are saying, wait, that's not what we had in mind. When we created this program for people in our state, we designed it for people going to college. Not sure if I'm okay with you using it for K to 12. It remains to be seen how the states are going to respond. Are they going to cut back the tax benefits? Are they going to modify the programs? For now, if you have money in a 529 plan, my understanding is at least the federal government is saying you can get them to cut a check to the local school for K to 12 tuition, and it's all good. Just the same as if it was being used for college education. So it'll be interesting to see what develops here in the next year or two in relation to that. Do you have a question? Or?
Another question. Could you clarify, you said this morning about teachers are employees and not subcontractors. Mm-hmm. That conversation. What are the ins and outs of boards requiring teachers to hire and pay their own substitutes? Is that not a problem?
I don't know. I don't think I've heard of that before. You're saying as an effort to keep them subcontractors?
Well, they're our employees, so if they call sick one day, then we should have someone else take their place.
Okay.
But it's hard for a board to be always taking care of them like that. Uh-huh. So, in our school, we do that. We tell a teacher that if they want to take a day off, they hire them my replacement.
What if they do it for 3 weeks or a month? You know, and it's a larger sum of money involved. How does that work? We still pay them the same amount, and then they take their paycheck to pay themselves.
Right.
And then they become subcontractors, and is that a problem for taxes? I'm reminded of a business article that I was reading recently of a guy talking about working, 5 hours a week. He said, hey, hire somebody to do your job. You get hired by a company, you hire somebody to show up for work for you, and you go do what you want. You know, of course, you pay them less than what you're getting paid. Anyway, so maybe some teachers, I'm not expecting teachers to do that. That's an interesting question. The thing is, that person, I think I would say the substitute is still under your control of the school. The school has the final authority as to whether that person's okay or not. You know, you can veto whether you want this person teaching. I would lean towards saying the substitute is still an employee of the school, not of the of the teacher. There might be cases where it would make sense for the teacher to pay them, you know, the school pay the teacher pay them. In that case, it would be the same as if I were to hire you to mow my grass, I think. I would be responsible to, or you would be responsible to report the income because you got it as a result of and I don't think it would be deductible for the teacher. I think the teacher would still have to claim their full wage, not just the portion that they kept. Because they are getting benefit from, you know, a personal benefit from this person teaching. On their behalf. Is there a question?
I was going to say that the teacher is going to be paying the tax on that money and going to be paying the, everything's going to be withdrawn. So as far as tax stands, this is our tax going to be paid on it. I don't know where it stands as a subcontract or whatever.
In fact, that's my understanding. In that case, his taxes would be paid twice. Actually, should be paid twice, both by the teacher who's getting the income, and then by the substitute who is again getting income. Whereas if the payment was going straight to the substitute, you would, I think, bypass that one taxable situation.
Wouldn't it be, if it's under, what is it, $600, they wouldn't really need a 1099, or you're saying they still, the person that receives it's going to report it, not the other party?
That's correct. The person who receives it would always have to report it, no matter how much they got. If they were working, okay, so an individual working for an individual does not get a 1099. Like if I hire you to cut my grass and I pay you $1,000 over the course of the year, I don't give you a 1099 because I'm an individual, I'm not a business. However, if you're doing it for me as a business, I do need to give you a 1099. So yeah, even though it's, if it's a dollar, it's recordable, unfortunately, as far as income is concerned. A lot of clients of ours have the idea that if it's under 600, you don't have to report it. Well, as nice as that would be, unfortunately, it's not the law.
But you might not be taxed on it.
But you might not be taxed on it, depending how small it is.
Well, just thinking about the technical aspects. So if I was a teacher, I mean, that's my qualifications, and so I contracted the school to teach for a year, then, and I get so much on my contract, and then I would hire a substitute for when I don't want to be there, then what I pay the substitute could be a business expense, couldn't it?
Yes. However, one of the reasons why I said you don't get a tax benefit is because unreimbursed employee expenses, which is what this would be, are generally taken as an itemized deduction. Unreimbursed employee expenses, unfortunately, under the new tax law, have been eliminated. You can no longer write off unreimbursed business expenses. And here's another one that I would mention that might hit you as a school board. Moving expenses can no longer be reimbursed tax-free. Somebody moves to your area, used to be able to pay them, you know, mileage or actual expenses and so forth. That is no longer tax-free. As of January 1st of this year, again, this the Trump tax bill changed that. So, yeah, those two aspects have been eliminated. So it's, yeah, there's a few bad things. I think mostly good things financially with the new bill. But
if I'm an employee and I get reimbursed for mileage, that still doesn't count as my income, does it?
No. The difference is whether it is an accountable plan or an unaccountable plan, or a non-accountable plan. If it is an accountable plan, what that means is you are telling your employer, I drove this number of miles, here's the receipt for my lunch, here's the receipt for my motel, and then the employer cuts you a check. If it is a non-accountable plan, the employer is saying, look, we know you put a lot of miles in your car, we're going to give you $200 a month for the mileage on your vehicle. They can do that, but non-accountable plans must be included in income. Used to be, then the employee could turn around and deduct it as a unreimbursed expense because, you know, if you're treating it as income, then you can take it back off your taxes. Now the IRS is saying you can no longer take that off your taxes. So if you are under a non-accountable plan where you're paying someone, they don't have to give you proof that they spent it a certain way, then that must be included in income. But if you are requiring, you know, proof that, and you can also advance somebody, so they give you $200, if you don't use it, you have to return to me what you didn't use, plus receipts for what you did use. That's okay. But it has to be returned within, I think, 30 days or something like that. So, you know, there's a things that you have to follow there. But as long as they're substantiating that, yes, it was used this way, or they're getting reimbursed for specific expenses, that's still fine. It does not need to be included. We are out of time. Thank you. You're dismissed.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.